Hello and welcome to another episode of the Challenger City TO podcast. In this episode, I'm really pleased to bring you a conversation with a man called Hans Bafija. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that properly. I'm sure he'll correct me if I'm wrong. But I first came across Hans through something in Toronto called the Innovation Supper Club that I host, and realized he's one of those people that kind of just gets how quite complex systems work, especially when they're quite political, and especially when they have quite a lot of history and rationale behind it. So I really wanted to have Hans on this podcast to talk about how we actually make some influence in Toronto to make some of these changes happen, because I appreciate none of this is going to be easy. And we have quite a wide-ranging conversation. It's probably the longest episode of this that we'll do, but I think it's a really, really enjoyable one, and possibly the one that helps us work out how we really make change happen in the city. So enjoy. So Hans, thanks for taking some time to have a chat with me about Toronto, because you are a man with many, many opinions and a great deal of experience of what works, what doesn't work in this city. Before we go into that, though, I want to get like a proper introduction for people listening to this to you and your storied background. So I'll let you go from that as a starting point for our conversation.
Well, I'll give you the abridged version. A young lad comes from London to Canada, 1975, with family. Dad worked in photography, photo finishing. In fact, part of the story, I mean, he came over to work in a photo finishing factory at Sherbourne and Lakeshore Boulevard called Chase Able Photo Finishing, Canada's largest photo finishers. So he was sponsored, came over with my sister, then proceeded to become Canadian, to be as Canadian as I can possibly be. You know, I lived in Scarborough, then ended up learning French, went to, you know, in high school, went to bilingual university, worked with my dad actually in photo finishing in the factories at Lakeshore and Sherbourne. So I have a, you know, manufacturing background, and then went on to work in banking. So I started in banking in high school. During that time, I took the money I made working in the factory to buy a computer, Commodore 64, became a technologist, went to university, became a political scientist, and then eventually became a consultant after working in banking for about 6-7 years.
It all reverts back to consulting, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You go through the journey, and where do you end up? Consulting.
Well, I'll give you a side story of that. So as in 1996, there was, after the recession stuff was going on and things like that, but I was working quite well in the banks and became a whiz at using technology and business processes, and became very useful to some of the seniors there in what was called Canada Trust. So I helped actually put together the operations for a wealth management division that was brand new at the time. And I ended up at one point, got frustrated with the politics, with corporate politics in the bank. And someone said to me, why don't you become a consultant? I was like, what's that? Now, I come from an entrepreneurial family community, so I like the idea of working for myself, but I said, still had no idea how consulting actually worked. So he gave me a small, little, tiny little contract that was helping Scotiabank with a merger with National Trust, keep the system alive, basically, kind of contract. People were stressed out. Can you sing a few songs, make a few jokes, and de-stress the people, which I did. And I kept that going. And then, yeah, I've been consulting since 1997.
There you go. At least you're a consultant that's come into consulting with experience in industry, unlike other consultants that are just experts at being consultants.
Correct.
That's
I mean, people were using my ability to, again, working in the factories, you learn a certain type of discipline working in the factories, right? I worked night shift, 50 hours a week, night shift, working with my dad at Lakeshore and Sherbourne. Then worked at other places with my dad and my mother too, and then went to banking and used the same kind of work ethic in the banks, same kind of innovation in the banks.
And where do you spend most of your time now?
Now I'm helping the federal government deal with baby eels.
It's quite a shift.
Well, it's supply chain, traceability, supply chain, and innovation, right? And it's regulatory.
No, it's really, I'd highly encourage anybody who is what the hell? Go Google baby eels, Canada, and it's an interesting story, an interesting problem.
The most expensive fish in Canada.
It's amazing.
It's the baby eel, otherwise known as elvers.
It's a great pub quiz question.
Oh, pub quiz, yes, indeed.
Anyway, enough about fish. You live in Toronto. You've been in Toronto a long time. I want to get your view of when I came to you and said, I'm doing this thing around Challenger City. What do you think of is the concept of a Challenger City? And how do you think that relates to the city of Toronto just now?
I would say up to maybe 20 years ago, Canada was a Challenger City. People don't realize the old core of Toronto was a very innovative place, actually, especially for banking and banking technology. I was involved in actually unplugging the stock exchange here, Toronto Stock Exchange, when I worked for Reuters. We developed an open source system, basically, and killed what they call CATS, a computer-assisted trading system. We had to lease the terminal from the stock exchange. We replaced that with client-server technology, LAN extension technology. But prior to that, I mean, the CATS engine on the Toronto Stock Exchange, I think, was used by the Paris Bourse at one point in time. So the combination of the trust companies, the brokerage companies, and the banks formed a pretty innovative hub down on Bay Street. Was Toronto an exciting city?
Was it?
Well, no, it wasn't. It wasn't exciting in terms of this was called Toronto the Good. It was a safe city. I mean, I think Peter Ustinov said it was run by the Swiss. Things tended to function. There was a corporate elite that ran the city. Politicians generally heeded the concerns of the citizens, and we got on with things. But then we had boroughs and cities creating what they call metropolitan Toronto. And a city was a challenger city. Like it listened to the needs of the people, of the denizens of the city of Toronto. It listened to industry. There were civil society organizations participating in the lifeblood of the city. This was a place where Mick Jagger would come and Rolling Stones would come, kick off their tours. Heavy metal bands would come through. A lot of the 80s bands would pass through here in the 80s. And we produced a lot of great artists coming out of Toronto, all the way, I guess, from 1920s, 30s, all the way up to the 80s.
So what went wrong? What did it all fall apart in the late 80s, early 90s?
Well, I think you end up with, when free trade gets signed, then you end up with banks merging with the trust companies and the brokerage companies. I can't remember the name of the act in this. US, you would call it like the Glass-Steagall Act, but I forget the act we did here. We basically got rid of the old antitrust acts and we merged everything. So now you've got these gigantic banking conglomerates that were focused on expanding into the US and capturing the US consumer, which is fair play. It's been a successful monetary venture for the banks, for the pension plans, and for a certain generation. They've benefited widely from that play, and they're still benefiting widely from that play. But the problem with that is you have organizations that are no longer Toronto-centric or Toronto-focused in terms of where they live and work and play. They live, work, and play elsewhere, not just in Toronto.
So it's some of that corporate elite that effectively possibly helped Toronto be a challenger city, as their attention got drawn to expanding beyond the boundaries of Toronto or Canada, that's where things start to get diluted and maybe that's where it starts to go wrong.
I think that's a great word for it, dilution. I don't think anything's ever intentional. I think in this day and age, people are putting a lot of intent into their vitriol, shall we say. It must be because of this, it must be because of that. But sometimes it's not because of anything. It's just dilution.
Yeah. And I guess along this same kind of time, you kind of have the Quebec referendum. Narrowly, Quebec doesn't leave Canada. And then a lot of the corporate headquarters from Quebec, which were a lot of banks, then moved to Toronto. And Toronto then goes through this period of, like, the city grew, but maybe it grew as a, we built more towers and there was more wealthy execs living here. But maybe what we lost is some of the investment in the infrastructure or the culture side of the city.
No, I think the Quebec referendum, and I went through a lot of these things later on, that the 70s referendum period, we saw the flight from Montreal, which was a challenger city at one point as well. It was the challenger city, actually. And Toronto was this Presbyterian Scottish banker city, if you want to call it that, where prohibition laws were around. I think the city of York, still up to about maybe 10 years ago, still had prohibition laws in place there.
I learned this the other day, the Junction had prohibition until the mid-90s.
That's exactly.
Which is wild. Like, if you think about it now, is like that's one of the last bastions of sort of hipster creativity in the city. And like not very long ago, you couldn't drink there.
That's correct. So you still had Toronto the Good at ending alcohol sales at 1 o'clock in the morning. I think it was like 12 o'clock on a Sunday. If you watch parking actually on Sundays, you get free parking before 1 p.m. because that's church time. So Toronto still has some vestiges of these old school Toronto rules.
There's bits of the city where you can park in no parking zones only on a Sunday morning because they're next to churches. So you're allowed to park on a junction.
That's right.
On a Sunday morning if a church is on the junction, which is, it's like, yeah, it's dangerous, but like it's God's work right now. So let's not get in the way there.
But even across the city, like it was generally free parking and before 1 o'clock in a lot of places just because that's just the way it was. And so Toronto was a safe city. So I think the difference in, say, Toronto versus Montreal is two challenger cities at one point. I mean, Toronto's calling card is, we are a safe city to live. We are a safe city to do business in. You don't have to worry here. We may not be as exciting as other cities, say New York or Chicago, but you don't have to worry in Toronto. And that was the calling card. Toronto is safe. Canada is safe.
And then Montreal became not safe. And that's why Montreal lost it, perhaps. Was Montreal something different?
Yeah, Montreal's a whole different discussion. I think Montreal is impacted certainly by the banks leaving.
Yeah.
Its corporate leadership left at that point, came to Toronto. So we benefited in Toronto. But Montreal is a whole other conversation.
Yeah, well, let's not go down there. I'd argue Montreal is a challenger city now for totally different reasons.
That's correct. That's a different story. But Toronto had that combination of safety. It had a great music scene coming out of the 1920s, actually, 1930s. Jazz, blues bands, rock and roll bands, Rush, for example, Triumph, two major bands coming out of here. Then you get actors came out of Toronto as well. So lots of famous people coming out of Toronto all the way up into the 80s and 90s. And then the culture of the city has changed in the last 20 years.
What's really changed? What's the big things that you look at and go, maybe that's where it went a bit wrong, maybe that's where it changed, for better or worse?
Well, you can go back to 1997. So you go back to, again, the mergers of the banks does one thing, dilution of leadership. Then you get into the amalgamation, which a bit of a pub quiz is actually ran for mayor in the amalgamation election. So I ran for mayor at that time period to do some research. But the merging of all the cities and the boroughs at the time, all the cities got merged, also dilutes leadership. Because before you had all these mayors competing, competition, innovation. If you don't like Scarborough, go to Etobicoke. If you don't like Etobicoke, go to North York. But no matter what you say about Mel Lastman, he was famous for his garbage pickups and things like that. He ran a pretty tight city when it comes to services provided to his citizens. Scarborough was fiscally responsible. We had a great music camp. I don't know if you know this, but the Bare Naked Ladies comes out of the Scarborough Music Camp.
I did not know this.
Yeah, that's where they met. And I was a camp counselor in Scarborough Arts Camp. We had one of the best boards of education probably in the entire world. Mike Myers comes out of that, for example, right? And a lot of my fans did very, very well out of that old Scarborough board. City of Toronto had its own board as well. So each one was competing with each other in terms of services provided to its citizens.
And I guess, like, if you look at it, like, what's now, I think it was called Old Toronto, but like downtown,
yep.
The needs of that place are really quite different to the needs of Scarborough, the needs of Etobicoke. Etobicoke and Scarborough may have commonalities. They have quite different populations, but the way that both areas are built is relatively similar, I would say. But like when you push them all together, you end up becoming the blob rather than creating something that's specifically relevant to one area over another.
Correct. I remember as a kid in Scarborough going to Scarborough Town Center, and they had there's a Bell building that was built there. The mayor came out, Gus Harris. I think there's a picture in the Scarborough Mirror of me peeking out, because I was shy at the time. And you can see my head peeking out to see Gus Harris. Like Gus Harris, actually, he's from England, actually. He was an English-born fellow, and he was the mayor of Scarborough. And we Scarborough people are very proud of Scarborough and would come down to the city or to North York, whatever. But we were Scarborough people. And downtown people were downtown Toronto people. And people in Etobicoke were Etobicoke people. Different needs, different histories. But the mayors were accessible. The mayors knew the needs of the people. They knew the ins and outs of what those ratepayers, you want to call them, the ratepayers, especially back in the day, ratepayers had a lot of power. So the ratepayer, the neighborhoods, the mayor looked after them. They were his electorate. You want to be elected, you got to look after your people. And so therefore, policies were designed to look after local taxpayers. Do we do that anymore? That's a question, right?
Do you think so?
I don't think so. But again, I'm not in the position of power to say yay or nay. I don't know what goes in the minds of current councillors. But from my own experience on the ground, because I do I do a lot of work in my neighborhood, in my community, I'm pretty close to the interaction between the bureaucracy, the politicians, and the people on the ground, and the ratepayers.
Yeah.
And you don't see the same dynamic you once saw in local politics.
I was listening to something the other day it was a couple of English mayors talking about how the best way to think of them is really being CEOs of their city or their region. That means they have to care about the complaint that's coming in from a little old lady whose bus route has been taken away and that was her lifeline. That is just as important as paying attention to the headquarters of a global corporation in that city that needs something to work differently for them.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. That's how it was before. The mayors, the councillors, I mean, back in the old days, when I was growing up, it was the aldermen, same thing as they do in London, right? But these people would walk the street and hear the din of the street. Who does that now? Like here, I live in Liberty Village. Well, just outside of it anyway. I will never claim I live inside of it, but I live on the outskirts and I get to watch from my window what goes on down with all the traffic and the crime and whatever else goes on. Since when has a counselor actually got themselves involved in the local stuff?
Yeah.
Really got involved besides a soundbite or a press conference. When do they go walk the street? I don't see that anymore.
There's an interesting thing of, again, going back and leaning too far into British politics here, but apparently John Major was phenomenally good at this.
Yeah.
So like even like he was seen as a very boring grey man. But when he would like he would go and walk around his constituency, when he was campaigning, he would literally take his soapbox and people would heckle him thinking he was this boring man that they saw on the television. But he was actually fantastic at having the retort. So he kind of knew, like he knew what was going on in his area. He knew how to converse with a politician, a businessman, a fruit and veg seller in Brixton. And I think like that's a thing that we don't necessarily see in the same way. Like if I walk down the street here, I think most people wouldn't know who their member of parliament is, who their provincial representative is, or who their local councillor is.
Well, I'll give you know a shout out to the NEP fellow of mine riding here, Chris Clover. He does do that. He does do the hot chocolate circuit, you know, very Canadian, goes from hot chocolate. The question is, though, when there's a crisis, do you actually come out? And when there's a crisis of traffic or crime, do you have a solution that helps the citizens, people who are paying taxes, for example, people who are expecting safety for the taxes? Is that happening? I don't see that piece happening.
Yeah. We don't like criticism is a thing. I think that's a sort of a business person doesn't like that. A graduate doesn't like it. A politician doesn't like it. But it's kind of critical for an elected representative to be able to take criticism and then do something with it rather than see it as a personal affront.
Yeah. I think that the most recent case of you know, when we say Challenger City, listening to the needs of the people who live in your city is key.
Yeah.
Like, no offense, we talk about the Toronto Regional Board of Trade. It's Toronto Regional. So it's listening to Oshawa, it's listening to Hamilton, it's listening to Mississauga, it's listening to Markham. But they don't live here. We built a subway to Vaughan. But they don't live here. They don't pay taxes here. And politics is, they always say politics is always local. But is it any more local? That was always when I was growing up and as a political scientist, it was politics is local.
It's a bit where do you draw the boundary, isn't it? I appreciate if someone who lives in Oshawa or Mississauga bitches and moans about traffic and we'll pick on Toronto Border Trade because they've just done their thing today as we record this. But yeah, I don't want people from Mississauga sitting in traffic because that sucks because it sucks for anybody else who's sitting in traffic. But there is a train to Mississauga, to downtown Toronto, and it's run by the province. I don't really have an awful lot of sympathy for it. But then we have a subway that goes outside of the city. And it brings people into the city and those people spend their money in the city. But if you dilute it so far, then it's why are we designing a city for people who live in the suburbs outside the city? That's when we lose it.
Right. And I've got enough issues in my little neighborhood that needs attention now. We probably have the worst traffic anywhere in the country. Literally, Liberty Village is a disaster zone. The local councillor, previous local councillor, when I asked him, what are you doing about it? I spoke on behalf of the police, actually, because I'm at the local police civilian committee here. As co-chair, I went to the local council. We've got a problem of emergency access for vehicles. And that was a few years back. It's even worse now. And I get told, studies have been done. There is no issue. What do you want me to say to that? I'm in an official capacity, while volunteering my time to help the police and citizens. And I'm going to see my local councillor and I'm dismissed with studies have been done. Well, 10 years later, whatever it is, it's gotten worse. And there's a new, I call it new sheriff on the block. I actually wrote on the Facebook page, new sheriff on the block, new counselor. And someone says, well, I'm going to go ask for those studies.
Yeah.
And see where it goes. Fine. But now it's even worse down here, right? It is in fact a public safety issue. People are getting frustrated now and starting to take the law into their own hands or the roads into their own hands, driving wherever they want. But again, is it intentional? No. Is bad planning? Absolutely. How can you, they've got five more towers going in into Liberty Village, five more. And then you've got Ontario Place. Right now, there's an issue where I think Budweiser Stage has said there's no parking available at Ontario Place. Didn't tell anybody this. They just put it in a little mail out to people who bought tickets. So where are you supposed to park? Guess what? Liberty Village. Well, the citizens don't control their neighborhood anymore. And where's the councillor? The councillor should be up in arms. Councillor should be on TV demanding or asking the police or blocking, whatever. They come up with a solution that says, this is a neighborhood. There are people who live here who have, there are elderly people here. There are seniors here. There are people who have accessibility issues here. People deserve some peace of mind.
It's interesting the challenge I see, and as you're talking it through, the left hand doesn't talk to the right hand because we have the challenge of virtually every conversation at a dinner table in this city is around congestion or housing. So we go and build more towers in Liberty Village without necessarily thinking, well, how do people get to and from Liberty Village? Because the streetcar doesn't work very well. It doesn't have a subway line. The train service is spotty at best. And the congestion sucks, but we still build the towers. And I bet we build like a 4-story parking garage underneath them. There's redevelopment at Ontario Place. We'll close the parking lot so the construction vehicles can stop there. Like I went down there because I have a broken shoulder. I couldn't ride my bike down there. I went down in an Uber and there's a sign that says Uber parking, but it's closed. You're not allowed into that. So the Uber has to drop off on the lakeshore, which then causes more traffic congestion. And it feels like all these things end up becoming somebody makes one decision, but it's not integrated into another piece. And then that's where everyone gets loud and shouty, but we don't necessarily have solutions to it. But to me, like, the solution is quite obvious. It's discourse and dialogue that we're not having anymore. If we had that, then we would make decisions in a joined up manner.
Well, I think we have discourse and dialogue. I think we have overabundance of discourse and dialogue. It doesn't mean anyone's listening to you.
Yeah.
Although there recently was a case recently of a friend of mine showed me the city passing a bylaw that said no feedback received. So there was no dialogue. They didn't even ask for it. And, you know, money is being put into general funds and being spent however they feel like. Again, not being spent to the best interest of the local neighborhood, being spent to the best interest of what the administration would like to see happen, which is not necessarily aligned with what the people in the neighborhood will want. Again, we go back to this gigantic thing called the City of Toronto. I think in Montreal, they actually did some de-amalgamation. So some pieces that didn't want to be part of the big City of Montreal, and they actually went back to their original municipality. That would be a solution, potentially. Don't think it's going to happen. I don't think the province wants that to happen, but it would give more power back to the people.
I think about like locally, we have like bike lanes and Bloor, and other people love them or they hate them. There's very little in the middle. But it was interesting when they were doing the consultation of it. It's like, here's a link to a survey that's really not been designed very well. And it's sort of designed to give the answer of, yeah, okay, go ahead with the original plan of building the bike lane, rather than be like, I'm a big advocate for them building that bike lane, but not the way that they've done it. The way they've done it, and actually, like, you've managed to piss off drivers and you've pissed off cyclists.
I think the worst thing that's actually happened is I was walking down Bloor Street the other day because my son plays soccer nearby. We had a game the other day and I was walking by. How many boarded up shops, right? They don't have the foot traffic anymore. They don't have the cars pulling up, grabbing out, grab a coffee, back in. And I bike too. I understand. I've been biking for years in Toronto. The challenge, though, is not everybody bikes. In fact, most people don't bike. We lose sight of that. Most people actually don't bike. Senior, we have an aging population. They don't bike. Many people don't bike. And if they do bike, do they bike in the wintertime? So 6 months of the year.
Oh, I'll have that argument with you because we don't have 6 months of winter, but keep going.
I know. I'm just using the word 6 months. But you also rain.
Yeah.
Add the rain in, add the snow in. For a good portion of the year, people are not going to be on their bikes on the bike lanes. So where is that balance? I understand the need for bike lanes, but I used to bike without bike lanes. So I'm an experienced downtown biker. Those of us from that generation of downtown bikers or street bikers, we knew how to ride in an urban setting. Conversely, most of the drivers were fairly decent drivers. What's happening now is the driving culture is disintegrated. It's a crisis point now. I'm seeing things once every 10 years, I'd see something. Someone cut a red light. Now I'm seeing it throughout the week, even throughout the day sometimes. In fact, it's so bad, it's not even Toronto that's impacted. Let's not pick on just Toronto, the challenger city. It happened to me in Muskoka. Some little old lady cut a red light right in front of me to get to her local supermarket. I'm like, that never used to happen. Something's going on. It's not, again, it's not intentional. There's some kind of weird dilution thing going on. Society is taking matters into their own hands, even when they don't need to. It's some kind of instinct now that's changing the character of this of Ontario.
There's this interesting thing of like, I'm a huge advocate for bike lanes. But actually, if you designed a city properly, you wouldn't have any bike lanes. Because a bike lane is a kind of a sign that your road system has failed because your drivers can't respect a cyclist. So if you like you point to Amsterdam, but like in the center of Amsterdam, the roads are small, they've taken away a load of parking, but like they talk about it as like cars are guests on streets. Whereas I think we start from the thing here is like even a pedestrian crossing the street is invading the car space. I think like that's the realm we've got ourselves into. So the reaction becomes militant cyclists. And then militant cyclists piss off drivers and you end up in a situation that's actually good for nobody. How we work our way out of that is so important.
The militant cyclists, many of them aren't actually good cyclists either. Okay. So, and then you have the nonchalant cyclists who really get themselves in trouble all the time, right? Just, or people on their phones. And then you have the e-bike folks, right? My Indian colleagues. Yeah, my dad's from India. I know my Indian colleagues very, very well. I never imagined these kind of individuals would be over here. But they are. I talk to them all the time. And they're riding on the sidewalks. In fact, someone got killed not too long ago up at Dufferin Grove by one of these fellows. Ran into an old lady and killed her.
I was watching a food courier on a bike, just riding the wrong way down a bike. And I'm like, by the way, I stopped him. I was like, you're riding the wrong way. He's like, yeah, fine. And he like continued to ride the wrong way down the bike lane and then went through a red light the wrong way down the bike lane and hit a car. And you're like, this is why we have the situation that we're in of even when we give people nice things, we don't use them properly and we end up in a bit of a mess.
You know, all these little things we've talked about, dilution of leadership. I wouldn't call it lack of leadership, dilution of leadership. There seems to be a bit of a social contract issue going on between politicians, bureaucrats, and the people. That's basically encapsulates this dialogue, this discussion, so forth. But is anybody actually doing anything to resolve the challenge? The answer is no. So what is the purpose of living in a city, right? What does one live in a city? Is it because we want chaos? We want anarchy? We don't want public safety? It used to be a time where politicians used to focus on public safety. That was priority number one for any politician, safety of its citizens. When it went too far, jump in. I'm old enough to remember New York 1970s. Not a very safe place, right? I've walked through South Side Chicago. Most people haven't. They have no idea. But I've actually walked through the South Side. So I know what that feels like. Most Canadians have no idea what these things feel like. But we're in that tipping point right now. There are criminal elements taking advantage of this city. Some guy recently knocked on a door, guy answered the door, a guy punched a guy in the face. It was captured on Ring. It's in the newspapers.
If you go to punch someone in the face, don't do it with someone who's got a Ring doorbell. Surely that should be TBH 101.
I know. Put a mask on or something. You know, and you watch what goes on in Brampton. Now, that's not a challenger city. That's a challenged city.
I just need to like be the bad guy here, but like these places aren't cities. They're giant suburbs. Like they just don't resemble. They're like lots of mostly detached homes or townhouses that are newly built where you have to drive everywhere. They almost fail in the definition of a city for me. But like, I think that's the mentality we exist in when we talk about the broader trade, like representing all these different places, that we're now representing a blob of a suburb. We're not representing quote unquote a city. And that's where it gets really messy.
Well, I think the challenge here for Toronto is it's in danger of becoming a blob. Okay. If you talk to the arts people, and I'm involved with music and art stuff around the city as well, the culture that defined Toronto before is disappearing very rapidly. One can even argue it's disappeared. The condoization of Toronto has killed a lot of venues now for people to go to, right? That artists can find a home in, you know, hone their talent in, speak on a stage, et cetera, et cetera. That's missing as well. So the condos in the city have killed the whole streetscape.
This must be the fourth conversation we come back to. The venues, the over-condoization, the lack of ability to wander and discover, the blob. How do we fight our way out of this? So like, ultimately, when I started this, I used the quote from Olivia Chow saying, Toronto is broke. We don't have any money. We're not going to do any new projects until we finish the old projects. Like nothing is going to come as a savior from the municipal or provincial public sector in this city. It's just not going to happen. That means to me, like the money is going to come from private enterprise, but I'm not confident it's going to be applied in the right way. And even to make it work, we're still going to have to win the permission space from the city to go and do fun, interesting, new stuff. So one of the reasons I want to talk to you, Hans, is how do we do that? You understand these systems, you understand the city better than almost anybody I know. How do we work through that to win the hearts and minds of those people to effect positive change?
Well, there's got to be a lot of grassroots stuff. But the problem with grassroots, sometimes it's not sustainable. Like I've been involved in something called Toronto Dollar many years ago, working with Joy Kagawa. We try to create an alternate currency, legal one, legitimate one. You mean you bought a Toronto dollar for a buck Canadian, you would get 90 cents on the dollar if you asked for it back. And 10 cents went into a fund that we would use for local community projects. And it worked very well for many, many years, but trying to sustain it was the problem. And I give Joy Kagawa, the famous Canadian author, she was instrumental in having Japanese reparations for the Second World War when the government didn't return their goods. But she led that and spearheaded that along with some others. And we had a good committee. These kind of initiatives that are local based are important. Trying to sustain them is a challenge, but you got to keep it going. That's one. I think two, you need to have, I always tell my artist friends, I get disappointed in my artists and music friends. There's so much good content right now. Local Toronto Gotham type content. It's amazing. You know, you don't need to read Batman comics. You just look around. Embrace the chaos. This is a new Toronto. This is not Toronto the good anymore. Is it Sin City? I don't know. Sin City also implies a certain joie de vivre, shall we say. I think we're missing that piece. So let's get to that piece. This is the new Toronto. Fine. It's got these things that we don't like. But how do you portray it? Music, movies, visual arts. Embrace it. So it's another piece. Do we have a Williamsburg section of Toronto, for example? Not really. We had one, maybe Kensington, but we've kind of killed that now. Maybe we need a place in Toronto that's protected and arts can go there. You know, maybe the city needs to be convinced, don't touch this area. It's the last bastion left. I don't know. Obviously, try to give a break to entrepreneurs or local businesses? How do you give them a break? Rents being so high, it's a challenge. And even when they're operating, they have to worry about being robbed and things like that, especially on Bloor Street, things like that. So you need to give them safety, right? So we need to get back to public safety. That's critical. So how do you do that? Again, it's a conversation between the chief, the mayor, and the councilors. And they have to say, hey, the lifeblood of the city is safety at the end of the day. We need to get back to that. And you can feel it. People want to see this happen. They're not quite sure how to do it. But I think we need a broader debate. You know, the Board of Trade used to actually host these debates. They've gotten away from the debate. Now, I've been a member of the board for, by the way, since 1997, 98, 30 years, I've been a member. But we need to have more citizen debates. You know, what are those issues that the people of Toronto feel need to be addressed? When was the last time you saw that?
No. Well, like, to be honest, the closest I think we see to a debate these days tends to be really loud, often quite privileged voices, more often than not execs, white collar employees. And we don't hear the, like, again, and someone else has said this on these conversations, we don't hear from the school kids, we don't hear from the elderly, we don't hear from the immigrant. We kind of hear from the same people again and again, shouting into the void of this is broken, but we don't necessarily hear a, how can we do it differently? And what help do I need to be able to make my vision of how I do it differently a reality?
Yeah, we kind of outsourced our policing of our own neighborhoods, like policing being small, people policing ourselves. Ultimately, you police yourself. Ultimately, you look after your own safety, your own security, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Police can only do so much. So we need to coordinate ourselves to have our voices heard. You can't expect the professional politician now to look after you. You can't expect the professional bureaucrats to look after you.
I don't know how this comes back to safety quite right, but I've never seen a police officer walking up and down Bloor West Village or Runcie or Ossington. I've seen lots of like police officers in cars cruising around. And I don't want to sound all hokey and like harking back to the 1950s or whatever, but actually like a police officer walking around a neighborhood or an area of a city is doing their job because sometimes someone goes up and says, can I get directions to such and such a place? Or by the way, something's happening just down the street that would probably benefit from your attention, officer. Like those kinds of things, like that interaction doesn't happen here. I actually think New York does that a lot. Let's not get into a debate about how ethical their methods are. But you will see a lot of police on the street, and there are some like negative externalities of that. But there's also a lot of positive ones, and I don't see that in Toronto.
So I have some insight into what you just touched upon, because Toronto Police in 14 Division actually had, or still has, I guess, a pilot project that they were doing to put officers into the local areas, right, to keep an eye on things here and there. I don't know where it is right now. It's a good question. I should bring that up in the next police meeting in September.
I had a team that actually worked on that.
Yeah.
They did ride-alongs in areas like Jane and Finch with Toronto Police, being like, how do we do community policing? It's interesting.
Correct. So they have been doing smaller bits and pieces of that. So give the police credit. And they were actually looking at the New York Police Department, right, NYPD, and that program that you talked about, the police being in the neighborhoods, keeping an eye on things. So they were actually mimicking working with New York on that program here. We do have the bike patrols. They do ride around here. I see them. So they do that. We do have the horse patrols. They do ride around on the horses, get them out of the stables, right?
I have seen horse shit on the street a few times down where near you live, but I've chosen not to bring it up.
Yeah, well, they walk by underneath my balcony all the time. So the police do have elements. Do they have a real consistent Bobby-style program? The answer is no, where that police officer really knows your street, your hood. I mean, it's a resourcing issue. Unfortunately, you know, with the whole Century Initiative thing, right, grow our population to 100 million people as fast as possible, it doesn't take into account public safety, security, bureaucracy, all those things that are necessary to maintain order. So are we catching up? Are we able to catch up to the levels that are required to maintain order with our current population at 41 million across the country? Again, most of the population being centered in Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, maybe Calgary a little bit, but I don't know. The jury's out. We're living in a grand experiment right now. I think the challenge right now, to go back to what we were saying earlier, is the dilution of leadership. Sure, we can have the bottom up because ultimately, like I said, security and safety start with yourself and your own person. I can't blame somebody else for my own safety at the end of the day. I've got to look after it. At the end of the day, look after yourself, right? I learned that from my grandfather. He went through the partition of India. He became a stateless refugee with his family. He had to make the call. He couldn't depend on the authorities. He made a decision and he survived and then prospered later on. Now, prospered is a relative term. Survival was prospering. But these kids got a fighting chance and they carried on and they prospered. But again, individual decision-making at the grassroots level. That being said, we pay taxes. If I didn't pay taxes, I wouldn't care so much because I'm looking after myself. I'm not off the grid. I'm on the grid and we pay a lot of taxes. The question that people have to ask is, what am I getting for it? Mel Lastman was very famous for, you're getting this and this and this for your taxes. Re-elect me. And he did. He became the longest serving mayor, I guess, until Hazel McCallion beat his record. But give Mel credit. I met Mel a number of times on the campaign trail. He is very good at that, detailing what he's providing to his citizens. Are we doing the same thing now?
So like, tax is just a dirty word these days, because I think we've lost trust on where our taxes go. In some cases, we don't actually even know where our taxes go, possibly because we've been poorly educated, possibly because I'll express some skepticism of whether they are used effectively and efficiently. But it now means that like, even when tax is good, we don't see it as good. We see it as inefficiency. We see it as waste. We see it as lost. Where rather than being like, well, that pays for the road, that pays for the school, that pays for whatever. I do appreciate that Montreal, when you pay your city taxes in Montreal, you pay a municipal tax, you pay a city tax on your property, and then you pay a separate school tax. And you look at it and like, I would go, hang on, $500 or $700 for a single family home in Montreal to pay for schools? My God, I don't even have kids and that's incredible value. Like, I think that that's where it's, you almost need to have like, how do you rebrand and tell the story of where does the money go? And maybe we don't want to know that. Maybe people don't want us to know that. But like, I think that's a really important thing to do so we have trust in tax.
That's right. And you go, trust is a key thing, right? Again, the social contract between the governed and the governors is a really important part of humankind, politics. There are those who govern and those who are governed. And there's a contract between this. At some point, if you don't adhere to that contract, revolution occurs. So we need to keep this balance there. The balance is tilting to being ungovernable. We need to help the governed and the governors, right? Maintain that dialogue, like you said. But you need to demand, where is the taxpayers' dollars going? Then the question is, where is it being directed to? Is it what we need? And what are the key priorities? Prioritization is key for any consultant. Where are our priorities? What's the KPIs? We're not doing that. I would add to that that, again, we go back to dilution of leadership. We need leaders, people with influence, skin in the game, to stand up. We don't have that. New York City has that. New York City has a pretty strong and effective elite that are active in their governing their community in New York City. And they every so often they have to get involved in these things. We had that in Toronto. We don't see that much of that anymore. We need to convince these elite to be invested in their city.
So do you think there's a big role for the private sector here? So basically, whether that's the CEO of an organization, whether that's an entrepreneur, is there a role for these sort of non-political types to start shaping the future of the city? And how do they go about doing that?
Well, I think you have to have private sector shape the city. They live here. Their workers live here. It's to their benefit. London has a lot of that. The burghers of London, England, are very active in helping shape the city, fighting things that shouldn't be there. I've seen that happen. They say, no, that building will block sunlight coming into a synagogue. It must stop. And it does. They get together and they stop it. We need to see these voices heard. Find out who are the allies of Toronto and have their voices heard, right? And shape the city. We need to have a blueprint for the city. Where is the city going? Otherwise, the flight that's going on right now, that's quite detailed in newspapers, a flight from Toronto or from Canada, but let's say Toronto. Do we want that flight to keep going? Why are people fleeing? Who is going to stand up and say, no, we want people to stay here? The other part is families. Without families, you don't have a city. Like, people forget that. I mean, I've got two kids, 10-year-old and 7-year-old. The reality is, it's my children who are the lifeblood, not the immigrants.
You're also in a minority of you are raising a family in the city. Whereas
yes.
We actually haven't built many properties for people like you to raise a family in the city, unless you are kind of very wealthy or grandfathered in. Because we're not building family homes in either downtown or even in some of the neighborhoods. Like, the capacity is dropping rather than increasing. I think it's interesting you talk about the flights. Like, when I started this, it was partly driven by being a bit pissed off of bank CEOs saying we need people to come back to the office. And I look at it as, you're the CEO of a bank. A lot of the real estate around you is yours. You're invested into it, but you're not creating an environment, let alone the desk that the worker sits at, but the environment the office is in. You're not giving a reason that someone can do their job better or enjoy doing their job more by going into a downtown office compared to doing it in their spare bedroom when they're on Zoom calls all day anyway. But then it's not just about people returning to the work from the office and therefore spending more time downtown 9 to 5. But it's also about people staying in the city. Like, this flight is I think it's really interesting. Like, it's not like on the scale of Detroit's flight from the suburb, like flight to the suburbs in the 60s and 70s. But it's more than a trickle of people that are going, Toronto's just not worth the cost anymore. I'm just going to go live somewhere else, whether that's moving to Calgary or whether that's leaving Canada. That's the frightening thing. Because as soon as that tax base goes back to the Toronto is broke, well, Toronto's even more broken.
Well, that's where the adult conversations have to happen with the corporate leaders. The other aspect too is academia. Toronto is flush with degrees, diplomas, certifications. I mean, Canada is, in general, we are the most educated, most certified, most professional country in the entire world. That's a fact. Which makes Toronto probably the most educated, most certified, most professional city in probably the entire world. But what are we doing with all that? We should demand that the presence of colleges and universities come together, bring some of their best and brightest to help assist with this conversation, right? And solutioning.
Or it says that what they're accrediting and what they're giving degrees and diplomas for isn't worth the paper it's written on. And I think that that's the, I don't want to go down that path, but it's like there's different sides of looking at the same thing. It's just one, we are the most educated country on earth. So therefore, how do we apply that knowledge in a better and different way? Or maybe all that knowledge, air quotes, isn't necessarily real knowledge or wisdom or critical thinking. Like, I think there's lots of people who speak about this way better than I do around like the future of education. But I think that's a really important point that you bring academia into it and not just private enterprise.
Well, you know, if you contrast, say, US and Canada, two very different entities. As much as Canadians think they know the US, it's vastly different. The policing is different, for example. Our policing was based on Peelian policing principles that the police should serve the community. The US is the police should serve the taxpayer, the property owner. Very different mindsets developed in Canada and the US. I was struck by all this when I was down at, I mentioned earlier, walked through the south side of Chicago from Garfield Station. I walked over to the University of Chicago. I was on a business trip. My friends decided, let's go down there. I'm like, okay. Burnt out houses, all these things going on. It was a bit crazy. But when you're in the south side of Chicago, all these burnt out houses and all these things, you're in the ghetto. And then you end up in the University of Chicago and you go through this green space, there's rivers and there's guys fishing away. And then all of a sudden you're on the campus of one of the wealthiest universities in the world, University of Chicago. And you're struck by this dichotomy. Here's University of Chicago, Barack Obama, Milton Friedman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then here's a ghetto, just a few minutes walk across the green space. How can this happen? How can this August university not be able to help something right next door? But that's America. America is very much bifurcated like that. Canada was never bifurcated to such an extent. Sure, it always happens. You can't avoid it. But really, you could go from neighborhood to neighborhood. And sure, you go from Rosedale over to Jamestown. But really, at the end of the day, you were safe. It wasn't such striking. People just went about their business. And I'm afraid that we're going to get to that point here. We're going to end up with American-style, uncaring type society. Now, in America, you know it's uncaring, so you're prepared for it. You strike hard, you work hard. It's a very aggressive place. And that's America. It's fine. But we're not set up that way, right? We're not set up that way in the Canadian mindset. So we need the universities to help shape these visions. Whether or not the paper you earn is worth it or not is a different story. But they have the resources, the arenas, the classrooms, theaters, the rubric to pull these things together. In theory, that's what they do.
Yeah. It's a great, education is the great level, basically.
Correct. And it serves a different purpose in the British, Canadian, Australian academic system is very different than the US system, which is much more corporate, much more profit oriented. You pay a big fee to go to the Ivy Leagues for a reason. Whereas here, it's more egalitarian. So therefore, the onus is on our universities and our community colleges to play more of a role in how we see ourselves structured in years to come.
It's back to the story thing again. It keeps coming up in these conversations is, what is Canada's story? What's Toronto's story? Where do we want to get to and how are we going to build it? And like, that's where I don't think we have a coherent vision. I don't think we have one that we can tell the story of. And if we can't do that, then you definitely don't have the building blocks of how to get there. So in a way, it's kind of sad because it's some basic shit that we've got to go and get right. But in another sense, it's quite basic stuff. So it's all very doable. It's not insurmountable. But to me, that's the silver lining.
There's also a generational changeover going on. I mean, we underestimate the power of a generational shift. So you've got the baby boomers. Many of them are friends of mine. And they've been running the show for 40 to 50 years now. One could even argue longer. And they may be another 10, 15, 20 years. But below that will be millennials / Gen Zs will come in after that. they're becoming a very angry generation. I can feel it from them when I talk to them. But they have no power for their voice. They're not decision makers, generally speaking. They're not really mainstream influencers. Sure, they have their pockets of influence, but really they don't govern society. So what happens when they start to become the leaders? What's that going to look like? I don't know.
I think millennials as one, and I don't like to be too generous when it comes to generations, but I think there's a generation of millennials coming in now that perhaps are a bit accepting of the status quo and aren't necessarily prepared to shake things up enough. But if you talk to a lot of people in their sort of early 20s, like the sort of the older vet end of Gen Z, my God, they're angry.
Yeah, that group. That's the group I'm talking about, right? The lower millennials.
Yeah, they're going to change stuff.
The question is, what will they change? What will be there left to change? And that's why there is an opportunity now to convince whatever leaders are around that they need to do more.
So Hans, as we sort of wrap up these conversations, I like to sort of ask people, what's their magic wand of the one thing that they can do or that they would do to make Toronto a better place or more of a challenger city? What would you do with your magic wand?
I think I would do what I just said. I think we need to get those people who have influence, those people who have security, therefore they have nothing to lose, if you know what I mean by that. I mean, sure, they have lots to lose, but hey, you know, they're doing well, they're comfortable, they're educated, they've done all things they need to do. Now, what else are you going to do? You're just going to head down to Boca Raton and Key West? Is that your life now? I think we need to demand more of the elders. I come from a culture of elders. We need to get them out. We need to say, hey, those individuals you talked about, the Gen Zers, the angry group, they need your help. Your grandchildren need your help. You can't just flitter off somewhere and have a good time and have your pina coladas while everything's burning around you. So you need to be involved in that. So how do we do that?
I like the idea that there's these two generations with nothing to lose. There's the elders that have made it and can afford the risks. And then a younger group that, well, they may as well take the risk because it's got to be better than if you don't. I think that's the, it's really interesting if you like, it's that back to the sort of saying of design for the edge and get the middle for free. Leave those groups to decide, like to design the future of the city. I actually think we'd probably be in a better place than leaving it to the plop.
So I used to be on the board of something called the Kuchiching Institute on Public Affairs. It was a great institution, a Canadian institution. It used to be on CBC all the time. And it disappeared a few years ago. We used to meet up at Lake Kuchiching, you know, by Aurelia there. It was a four-day gab fest. But we'd have people from all over the world come down to Aurelia, to Kuchiching. You get Karen Armstrong, the writer, Ed Asner, four politicians, prime ministers, so forth, writers, thinkers, philosophers. We'll come down. We spend 3-4 days on a subject. It could be religion. It could be Canada-US relationship. We had Moses Neimer. We talked about arts and cultures. And Moses came, you know, from City TV. He came to what I read. I was a headline speaker. I would sit there as a young man in my 20s as a political science major. And I would be sitting there with Paul Martin Jr., for example. We'd be sitting at the same table together. And I'd still see him today. I'd say, oh, hello, Paul. And he's like, hello, and this and that. You know, if his wife was there, he'd bring his wife. And it was very Canadian. You wouldn't see this anywhere else in the world. I tell you this. It was a very Canadian experience. You'd have a farmer from Saskatchewan. The farmer had been coming to Kuchiching for 30 to 40 years. He would never miss coming to Kuch. And some of those Kuch people are still friends of mine today. And you would sit there and have these world issues dealt with from a Canadian perspective. Farmers, fishermen, bankers, all sitting together, side by each. What a wonderful Canadian experience. And then unfortunately, won't get into it, but for a number of reasons, it collapsed and it was gone. But that created the Canadian dialogue, the Canadian way of discussing things, which you would not see in the UK. You won't see in the US. Oh, there are parts of US. I think there was a conference similar to that up in upstate New York. Ithaca, I think, has a similar type of conference. But this is our Canadian experience.
But it's taking the tribalism out of it, which is actually an inherently Canadian thing, both in the past and I would argue in the future is the next generation. Someone else is on one of these said, it's actually going to be the immigrants that shape the future of Toronto, not people who've been here for 50 years. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not. But I think it's how do you take the tribalism out of it so that ultimately it's people from different shapes of walks of life, different backgrounds. Those immigrants can sometimes be better at doing that because they all come from different places. Sometimes they can actually lean in back into their tribes and they can be bad at it. But I think that's to me, the definition of Canadian is like passing off that tribalism and like forming a coherent argument as the collective without being the blob.
I would generally give you accept that with the essentially initiative approach, there hasn't been enough time for the immigrants who used to come in trickles. As you came in trickles, some people became Canadian. And some didn't. Some stayed Portuguese, some stayed Italian and stayed in their neighborhood. And that's fine. But they still generally were Canadian, right? We haven't given enough time for that integration, nor in our post-national Canada have we defined what it means to be Canadian anymore, which used to be peace, order, and good governance. That's defined our way of life versus the UK, US, or Australia. Canada had a very definitive POG approach. And that POG approach is well known at one point in time. I'm afraid that we've actually jettisoned the POG approach. We're not sure what approach we're taking anymore. So I think it's two things. One, we need the magic wand is how do you bring people together to get beyond the tribal approach? Two, how do we define what does it mean to be Canadian? I mean, the reality is Canada's constitutional arrangement is unique unto itself. That's what makes it the Confederation of Canada. Most of our population have no idea how it even functions. Well, there's a civics issue there. One could argue the UK, most people don't know how it functions. It just kind of functions, right?
We just sort of let it develop.
Yeah, Americans are very, very much, they're very aware of their politics.
Yeah, for better or worse.
For better or for worse. From the local sheriff who's elected to your district attorney, all that stuff, the elections are just part of who they are. Canadians, we take it for granted. The Brits probably take it for granted to some degree. Aussies too. And we just expect that our bureaucracy and our politicians and our corporate elders generally will do the right thing.
I think the thing the Australians do well, albeit I don't like it, is compulsory voting. It makes me feel very uncomfortable. But I look at like the British election that went by, the Toronto mayor election a year ago, the turnout's so low at this point that you can't be so vocally critical of your government when so few of your population voted for your mayor or for your in a national election for an MP that leads to a new prime minister. So that's where, to me, like I love your magic wand hands. I actually think it's a really important thing for the future because it's something that's clearly not on the right trajectory. Maybe it's not the specific solution, but it's a really important thing to course correct because from that, lots of other good things will follow.
It's certainly like the Empire Club. They try to have their very expensive talks. Their lunches are $100, whatever, and things like that. And that's fine. You have these one-hour talks, but it's got to be something more than that. And it's got to involve people in other parts of Toronto and other professions because not everybody has a university degree. Not everybody's a banker.
At a different point of view, like I think there's points where I would absolutely disagree with some of the things you said when we're talking about like bikes, like for instance, it's an argument I like to have, but it's those conversations need to be agreeable disagreements, not necessarily tribalism where it's people like flinging shit at each other. And I think that's where, if we can move the needle in that direction and create the forums for it, everything will become a better place. But hopefully that's one of the big ideas that comes out of this and we can fund it and make it happen. So,
yeah, because you got to think at your age, for example, you're a young, able-bodied male with no issues. So you get to think a certain way. But if you're my dad, I was with my dad yesterday, he's 84. He can't get around on a bike and he needs to walk somewhere to a local shop, but there's no shops open. And the local bike population is fairly aggressive towards old people. Get out of my way. I see it on the sidewalk.
Oh, cyclists are jerks to old people. 100%.
Except some of these cyclists will grow up to be old one day and it's going to happen to them. You talked about it earlier, wisdom. I think that's a piece that's missing, you know, is what is wisdom in today's day and age? What is that? I mean, so there are bigger, larger philosophical conversations where the universities can play their role. In theory, that's the role they would play is having those types of discussions. But when you go back to Challenger City and why one lives in the city versus living in a hamlet somewhere, the city should be having these conversations. It should be where you go to be fulfilled on various different levels that you're not going to get sitting in a hamlet.
I kind of hope that when we come back to this in a little while's time, we won't be talking about Toronto the good or Toronto the no fun city, but we'll be talking about Toronto the wise. I think that's where ultimately we kind of hopefully get to take this. Maybe we'll be long old and or dead or buried by then, but I think that's the legacy that the city as a challenger should really be aiming for.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I like that. Toronto the wise. That's the Toronto the wise. There's a t-shirt there.
Yeah, we'll get the t-shirt. But thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat with me about this today. This is great. We'll end the podcast here, but we hopefully won't end the impact it. So thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Challenger City TO podcast. You can find written up versions of all these interviews as well as a history of the other podcasts we've done to date if you go to challengercityto.substack.com. We'll see you again for another episode very soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.